The reading is from Matthew chapter 27, verses 1 to 31, which can be found on page 998 in the Pew Bibles. Matthew 27, verses 1 to 31. Early in the morning, all the chief priests and the elders of the people came to the decision to put Jesus to death. They bound him, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate, the governor. When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 silver coins to the chief priests and the elders. "I have sinned," he said, "for I have betrayed innocent blood." "What is that to us?" they replied. "That's your responsibility." So Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and hanged himself. The chief priests picked up the coins and said, "It is against the law to put this into the treasury, since it is blood money." So they decided to use the money to buy the potter's field as a burial place for foreigners. That is why it has been called the Field of Blood to this day. Then what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. They took the 30 silver coins, the price set on him by the people of Israel, and they used them to buy the potter's field, as the Lord commanded me. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear the testimony they are bringing against you?" But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. Now it was the governor's custom at the feast to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, "Which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" For he knew it was out of envy that they had handed Jesus over to him. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message, "Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" asked the governor. "Barabbas," they answered. "What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called Christ?" Pilate asked. They all answered, "Crucify him." "Why, what crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. "I am innocent of this man's blood," he said. "It is your responsibility." All the people answered, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." Then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers round him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand and knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. They spat on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him.
Jesus had been going about his public ministry for about 3 years, but now it's coming to its end. The religious authorities and the political authorities, well, they view him with suspicion and fear. The crowd, well, frustration, anger, and envy. They all want to get rid of Jesus. And so he's been arrested and brought before the magistrates. There is no evidence for the charges against Jesus, and yet he is condemned. Crucify is all their breath, and for his death they thirst and cry. And so Jesus, innocent though he is, will be executed, whilst Barabbas, the guilty man, walks free. We read in verse 26 that Jesus is flogged and then handed over to be crucified. And so the preparations begin immediately there in verse 27. Jesus is flogged again, which I understand would be quite normal. But Matthew also highlights for us something quite abnormal. They strip Jesus and put a scarlet robe on his shoulders, a crown on his head, a scepter in his hand, and they kneel before him. And yet, of course, this is no coronation. It is pure humiliation. Painful, no doubt, for Jesus, both physically and emotionally. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. They spat on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. When they've had enough, they redress Jesus and lead him away to be crucified. And a sign will be placed above his head, which reads, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." No doubt the mockery and abuse that the soldiers inflict on Jesus is meant to be ironic. Back in verse 11, when asked if Jesus was the King of the Jews, he replies in the affirmative, "Yes, it is as you say. But look at him now. Scarlet robe, crown of thorns. I wonder what you see. A fake crown, a stick for a scepter, beaten and spat upon. King of the Jews, king, really? Jesus is no king. He's a criminal." How clever they must have felt. Such mockery, such irony. And yet there is a deeper irony at work here, because though they mock Jesus as king, Jesus really is the king, not just over Israel, but over all. That's something that Matthew has been eager to show us, the readers, right from the very beginning of his gospel account. Back in chapter 1, we learn that Jesus is from the bloodline of Israel's greatest king, King David. And yet Jesus, the king, is more powerful than David ever was. In both his words and his deeds, Jesus has demonstrated his royal power and authority again and again. Not just by his miraculous power, but also the majestic way he cares for the vulnerable, lifts up the weak, and loves those whom others ignore. Jesus also described his reign for us in Matthew chapter 20. Following the disciples, they've been clamoring to get the best seats at the royal table. Well, Jesus describes for us what sort of a king he is, what his rule will look like. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Now, this doesn't mean that Jesus has no authority whatsoever. After he has risen from the dead, Jesus declares that all authority in heaven and on earth is his. Jesus' authority is no less than the authority of God. He is the King of the universe. And so he is king over the crowd who shout. He is king over the soldiers who mock. He is king over you and I here today. And he is the king to whom one day, the Apostle Paul reminds us, every knee will bow. But as we read of Jesus here in chapter 27, scarlet robe, crown of thorns, I wonder what you see. Is he a sham king or the servant king? Matthew wants us to be clear, this is not a criminal's mock coronation. Rather, what we have before us is the king of everyone, including you and I, laying aside pride and promotion and popularity, giving his very life in order to serve you and me. It is the king paying a king's ransom, giving his life. Wouldn't it be ironic if, with the benefit of hindsight, we still look upon Jesus as the crowd did, failing to live up to our expectations of what a king should be, so best to silence him? Wouldn't it be ironic if we still looked upon Jesus as Pilate did, someone simply to wash our hands of? Wouldn't it be ironic if we still looked upon Jesus like the soldiers did, as a criminal with delusions of grandeur, rather than see him as the true king that he is, before whom one day every knee will bow and tongue will confess that he is the Lord of all? Wouldn't it be ironic if, as his followers, we poured scorn on his service of us by refusing to serve others? All hail the King.
Continuing on page 999, Matthew 27, starting at verse 32, page 999. As they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. There, they offered Jesus wine to drink, mixed with gall. But after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him: "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Two robbers were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" In the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him.
As Jesus walks the road to Golgotha, we read of how he is now so weak that he cannot carry the cross for himself. But on arrival, they have not only stripped him of his strength, but also of his clothing. It's a reminder that the whole process of crucifixion was designed by the Romans to not only cause great pain, but also great shame. And so the soldiers who are there to make sure that he dies properly, well, they cast lots for his clothes whilst they keep watch. The sign above Jesus' head reads, King of the Jews. It was in three languages: Greek, the language of the world, Latin, the language of the Roman Empire, and Aramaic, the language of God's people. It's as if Jesus is being presented for the whole world to see and understand. Here is your king, weak, powerless, broken, and hopeless, numbered amongst the transgressors, one on his right, one on his left. Even they join in the insults. One writer has described the scene like this: suffering immeasurably, shamed intolerably, broken in body and spirit, without any prospect except the release of death, Jesus hangs on that wretched cross, utterly powerless. And still the mockery does not stop. And once again, it is thick with irony. Verse 39. Those who passed by hurled insults at Jesus, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." Well, if ever there was proof needed that Jesus was powerless, well, here it is. The one who said he was so powerful he could destroy and rebuild the temple in just 3 days, even though the last time it took 40 years. Well, look at him now, so weak he can barely breathe. Jesus had claimed to be so very powerful, supernaturally so. But as he hangs there on the cross, they see only his powerlessness. The call for him to save himself is, of course, ironic, because the onlookers are convinced that he cannot do a thing to save himself. He's a criminal, not a king, and a weak one at that. And yet there is, once again, a deeper irony at work here, because it is in his weakness displayed at the cross that Jesus demonstrates his power. When Jesus spoke of destroying and rebuilding the temple, he was talking about his own body. So whereas the temple used to be the place where God and his people would meet, where through sacrifice sinful people could be reconciled to God, now, however, the means by which all people will meet with God, enjoy fellowship with God, is through Jesus. And not simply through his taking on human flesh and walking this earth, but through his death on the cross and his resurrection from the dead. It is now only through Jesus' sacrifice that reconciliation with God is possible. So whereas the passers-by mock him for his weakness, the irony is that it is through staying on the cross in weakness that King Jesus is establishing himself as the temple, as the meeting place, the place of reconciliation between God the Father and rebellious people like you and I. If King Jesus was serving his own needs, seeking his own power, then saving himself would be the thing to do. But in seeking to serve and give his life as a ransom for many, he will not come down from the cross. And so it is with perhaps the greatest irony that we read the words of the chief priests, teachers of the law, and the elders in verse 42. He saved others, but he can't save himself. They do not deny that Jesus saved others. That is in the sense of restoring sight to the blind, reversing paralysis, raising the dead. How ironic then that Jesus could do all those things and yet not save himself. And yet, of course, it is only in his not saving himself that Jesus can save you and I. The nails may have held him there, but they are not what kept him there. So you see, they want Jesus to come down off the cross. Then they say they will believe in him. But if Jesus does not see this through, if Jesus does not die in your place and in mine, well, there is no point in believing in him. And that's because to believe in Jesus is to believe that he has died in our place, that he has paid the ransom, that he has borne the penalty our sin deserves. Those who mock speak a greater truth than they realized. He saved others. He can't save himself. Not because the nails were too strong or the soldiers too numerous, But because Jesus knows his mission, he knows the price, he knows the ransom that must be paid. It is only in not saving himself, in his remaining on the cross unto death, that Jesus can save you and I. So for all that Jesus deliberately suffers and endures, wouldn't it be ironic if we reject the salvation Jesus offers because we think we can try and save ourselves? As we read in Isaiah, surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed.
From verse 45. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of those standing there heard this, they said, he's calling Elijah. Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." Many women were there watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. The next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I'll rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. The last deception will be worse than the first." "Take a guard," Pilate answered. "Go make the tomb as secure as you know how." So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard.
As Jesus is still hanging on the cross in verse 43, the chief priests, teachers of the law, and elders continue. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him, for he said, "I am the Son of God." Again, their words are filled with irony. For when they say he trusts in God, what they mean is Jesus must be a fake. His trust in God could not have been real because he's clearly been abandoned by God. They knew the words of Deuteronomy chapter 21, anyone who is hung on a tree is cursed by God. And as Jesus hangs there on the cross, it is true, he has been cursed by God, abandoned, forsaken. And yet it is not true that Jesus has abandoned his trust in God. It is quite the opposite. Once again, those who mock are speaking deeper truths than they realize. Jesus does trust in God even unto death. Verse 45 again. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? His words there can sound like Jesus is abandoning trust, until we realize that his cry is actually a quotation from Psalm 22, a psalm that is full of expressions of confidence in God, of trust in God, in my God, as the psalmist writes, as Jesus speaks. And this is something Jesus has continually demonstrated. Just think, for example, of when Jesus was praying in the Garden of Gethsemane before his arrest. He's staring the cross in the face, but he prays resolutely, may your will be done. Jesus knows what he must do. He knows what he must face, that he must give his life as a ransom. So Jesus is not expressing a lack of trust, but something of the relational torment he endured for your sake and mine, where he suffers the separation from God that you and I deserve as he comes under the sentence of our sin. The 3 hours of darkness falling on the land that come just before Jesus' cry of anguish, well, they remind us of the divine displeasure that Jesus is facing. That Jesus, the Son of God, is being forsaken by God the Father. He is being cut off, abandoned by his Father in heaven, as he bears the full punishment of our guilt and sin. As he is there, Jesus is forsaken by the God in whom he trusts, the Father whom he loves. Now, why does he do that? To what end? Well, Jesus cries this cry of anguish so that you or I never have to. At the heart of the temple was a room called the Most Holy Place, which represented God's presence. And it was sealed off by a huge inner curtain, like a gigantic no-entry sign, saying you cannot come into God's presence unless your sin is dealt with. Well, we read in verse 51, as Jesus gives up his spirit, at that very moment that Jesus finished paying for our forgiveness, the curtain was torn in two from top to bottom. And it is with the tearing of the curtain that the way into the presence of God is now open to everyone, because the death of Jesus has made the full, perfect, sufficient, complete payment for your sins and for mine. The tomb may be securely closed, but the way to God is now open. With the tearing of the curtain, we are assured that Jesus trusting God unto death on that cross has been a success, that his being forsaken has won our forgiveness. And we are all now invited to draw near to God with boldness, to approach him with confidence by faith in Jesus Christ. With the tearing of the curtain, it's as if to say, look, if you trust in Jesus and his death for you, your sins are forgiven and you have access to God, permanent, unchanging access to God. And that doesn't depend on anything about you, but on what happened on that cross outside Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. And so it is, without a hint of irony, that the centurion witnesses all this and he exclaims, surely, surely he was the Son of God. One writer sums it up like this: there is no way to God that does not depend upon nails, thorns, ropes, and wood. The blood of Christ is the witness of God to the triumph of love, The blood of Christ is God's signature on his new agreement with us. The blood means that God means business and his agreement is valid. King Jesus died in weakness, shame, and ignominy. He faced the darkness of being cut off from his Father. Why? So that we do not have to. It is only through his forsakenness that we can be forgiven. Only through his separation that we can be reconciled. Wouldn't it be ironic if, in light of all Jesus has done for us, our hearts were not filled with praise? Wouldn't it be ironic if, in light of all Jesus has done for us, we didn't want to share it with others? It is because of Jesus that we have confidence. He is the foundation of our hope and our pardon, that though our sins may be many, the payment of our servant King far outweighs them all. That though you and I deserve to be forsaken by God, we are now reconciled to him. I'm going to close with some words of an old prayer, and then we'll take silence together once more. Christ was all anguish, that we might be all joy. Cast off, that we might be brought in. Trodden down as an enemy, that we might be welcomed as friends. Stripped, that we might be clothed. Wounded, that we might be healed. Tormented, that we might be comforted. Made ashamed, that we might inherit glory. Entered darkness, that we might have eternal light. Our Saviour wept, that all tears might be wiped from our eyes. He groaned, that we might have endless song. Experienced reproach, that we might receive welcome. Closed his eyes in death, that we might gaze on unclouded brightness. Expired, that we might forever live.